This episode of The Dig is brought to you by our supporters on Patreon and by Verso Books, which has loads of great left-wing titles, perfect for Dig listeners like you. One that you might like is How Will Capitalism End? Essays on a Failing System by Wolfgang Streeck, which is out now in paperback. The provocative political thinker asks if it will be with a bang or a whimper. After years of ill health, capitalism is now in a critical condition. Growth has given way to stagnation. Inequality is leading to instability. And confidence in the money economy has all but evaporated. In How Will Capitalism End?, the acclaimed analyst of contemporary politics and economics, Wolfgang Streeck, argues that the world is about to change. The marriage between democracy and capitalism, ill-suited partners brought together in the shadow of World War II, is coming to an end. The regulatory institutions that once restrained the financial sector's excesses have collapsed. And after the final victory of capitalism at the end of the Cold War, there is no political agency capable of rolling back the liberalization of the markets. Ours has become a world defined by declining growth, oligarchic rule, a shrinking public sphere, institutional corruption, and international anarchy. And no cure to these ills is at hand. How Will Capitalism End? Essays on a Failing System by Wolfgang Streeck. Out now in paperback from Verso Books. Welcome to The Dig, a podcast from Jacobin Magazine. My name is Daniel Denver, and I'm broadcasting from Providence, Rhode Island. I'm back from my holiday extravaganza of finally finishing the first draft of my book and drunkenly dancing on 2 Street in the freezing cold. So here comes your first diglet of the new year. And we're going to talk about that Trump book. At N+1, Patrick Blanchfield makes the case that fire and fury is not, as some might think, a bunch of meaningless palace intrigue that has distracted us from what Trump is doing to destroy the environment and wage relentless class war against the poor. Rather, the book in one fell swoop exposes the Trump administration for the dangerously hot mess that we all knew it was, but weren't able to understand clearly because of the deluge of drama and weird tweets which had rendered it all banal wallpaper. Before we get started, thank you to the more than 700 listeners who are supporting us on patreon.com/thedig. If you aren't supporting us yet and listen to the show, please do. We don't paywall a thing, and so we depend on your voluntary contributions. That's patreon.com/thedig. And one last thing. I get lots of compliments on the music we use on the show, and I wanted to let you know, as you may have noted in the credits, that it's by none other than my very talented friend, Jeffrey Brodsky. You can check out his work, commercial and artistic, at jeffreybrodsky.com. That's JeffreyBrodsky.com, and painterly, painterly.bandcamp.com. Thanks, and here's Patrick Blanchfield, a freelance writer and associate faculty member at the Brooklyn Institute for Social Research. Patrick Blanchfield, welcome to The Dig.
Thank you for having me. It's a pleasure.
You wrote a really excellent review of Fire and Fury, and I want to start by asking you just to set the table before we get to your take on the book of what the book is, what it lays out for any strange people out there living under a rock with their earbuds plugged in who only get their news from my podcast.
Sure. So Fire and Fury is a book by journalist / writer. It's kind of plumbing the gap between those professional terms. Michael Wolff, and it's about the transition of it opens. It's about the Trump administration. It opens with the election, the moment of the election day, and into the transition, and then covers the first 8 or 9 months of the administration, Wolf is a heavily credentialed journalist who has done previous work on Silicon Valley, has written a book about Rupert Murdoch, has done a lot about tech entrepreneurs and media criticism, etc. And he essentially had the book of Fire and Fury is the product of his more or less unfettered access to various players in the Trump campaign. More granularly, it's the output of about 200 interviews that he carried out over the course of, I think the first one happened in May of 2016 with Trump proper, and then essentially he maintained access to the campaign and then to the administration through about August or so of 2017, and it concludes in October of that year.
And it's not an exactly flattering portrait of the White House and the president, and has, of course, led to an immense amount of controversy and the exit of Bannon from Breitbart, amongst other things.
That's exactly right. It's a it's a pot boiler slash tell all that presents in a highly unflattering light internal deliberations, if that is the word for it, within the Trump camp. And it features a variety of quotes that are, this is why I sort of like flag, like, is this journalism or is this some other type of like parajournalistic endeavor? But it includes a lot of extremely, shall we say, candid statements from members of the campaign, from Trump advisors, from Trump friends, which is, again, another word that we could probably throw into scare quotes, saying what they think about Trump or what happened at various signal junctures during over the course of the past year. And as a result of that, there's been an attempt to quash publication. The lawsuit has been filed. This has done nothing but accelerate the accelerated the release date. And the last I checked, as of about yesterday, it had moved, I think, 29,000 copies in the first 3 or 4 days. So, good for Michael Wolff, I guess. It's nice to see somebody doing well.
Basically, one of the take-home points from the book is that almost everyone around Trump thinks he is a barely literate and mentally unstable person who is utterly unqualified and basically dangerous to have that job.
That is the kernel of the book, and in some ways both what it like we always already knew, but which is kind of like scandalous to see laid out in 250 odd pages. But yeah, the basic premise is that the entire Trump crew signed on for what they thought would be a wild election ride terminating on November 8th, and then after that they would all go their separate ways. As conservative pundits, as business operators, as movement conservative leaders, etc., but that none of them had ever seriously considered the possibility that this sort of clownish poltroon with whom they had signed on would actually be president. And then the output of that is, he's president now, so there you go. There's more than one analogy in the book, and of course this is an original thing of Wolf to say, but there's more than one analogy to the music, to the producers in it. So like the idea that a venture that is deliberately built to fail actually succeeds with the result that everyone involved is more or less fucked. Us.
The upshot of them being fucked is us being fucked harder. But the Trump campaign is comprised of a band of cynical and opportunistic grifters who never expect to win, and then they do. What does that tell us about how they have governed?
Rephrase that as a question into a statement, right? Like what happens when grifters like the grift succeeds is that they just keep on seeking other ways to continue the grift. I'm sure we could draw some analogy to like some classic like con man move where it's like the Spanish prisoner or like the Nigerian prince scheme or something like that, but where the mark falls for it, and then the con man is supposed to abscond with the money, but the mark just keeps paying, and so the con man just stays there. And it's a really surreal kind of continuation of an untenable situation, which is horrifying.
We might call it the Herbalife presidency.
exactly right. It's like take that pyramid on the $1 bill and then imagine that as a pyramid scheme presidency, and you basically have the Trump campaign become administration.
Okay, so now I want to get to your excellent review, and I want to read from it at some serious length. Some shows ask people to read their own writing. In the show, I read their writing for them. And I think this is a section that gets to its really well-crafted central thesis. "Its promised revelations are not really revelations at all," you write. "The fundamental scandal, the book's centerpiece truth, that the president is breathtakingly unfit and his administration is a slow-motion train wreck, has been obvious all along. The Trump catastrophe has been hidden in plain sight. It has filled our entire national field of vision such that, for those who follow the news even irregularly, there is little else to see. From scandal to scandal, from outrage to outrage, in a steady stream of cringe-inducing video clips and erratic tweets, this president and his administration have shown us who they are, time and again. Yet, as the past year has shown, this onslaught of the obvious can actually impose its own kind of normality, a learned posture of dumbstruck exhaustion and enervated disgust. And yet, while the state of affairs, experienced digitally, 24/7, entails a vertiginous dysphoria, a book like Fire and Fury, precisely because it is a book, circumvents our hypertrophied circuit of stimulus response and leaves the reader with a much more sustained, depressing, and horrified outlook. Yes, we realize, you can't make this shit up. But America has made it all too real." I love that passage, and I think what you're saying is that this book does something different than all of these nonstop accounts of Trump's pathological dysfunction that we've become so accustomed to reading about, because a book in this sort is this like this is this sort of consolidated event that makes us pause and reflect, and that makes this reality, our reality, rightly strange to us again.
I think that's exactly right. Right, like in terms of your assessment of it, like there is, we're in a weird moment in terms of how, and this is just like my theorizing off the cuff, but I think it's true, in terms of how like media and different modes of media sort of acculturate our subjectivities vis-a-vis current events. And
yeah, like Baudrillard comes to mind.
Yeah, that's exactly right. Like this we're in this like this kind of like hyper real like simulacrum sort of heavy moment, right? The desert of like the terrible, if you will, but like but like it is like, and Trump himself is like an interesting example of this, right? Insofar as that he's a baby boomer, right? Who is more than anyone
simultaneously a man child and a baby boomer.
Yeah, he's a man child and a baby boomer who is more of like a TV wonk and like a chronic TV watcher and like TV commentator. More than anyone I've ever seen, like more than anyone who's employed by like the E Network and like does like entertainment news, like this is like nonstop what he does. Except also, he's constantly on Twitter, right, commenting on TV. So it's this weird like simultaneous thing where it's like it's both, you know, it's TV, which is on some level last gen, but also it's Twitter, which is of the moment, or maybe I'm told that people younger than like 20 are not on Twitter anymore. I don't know, which is terrifying to think of.
Hey, we're still young. We're still young. Go ahead.
Yeah, we're still young. Like he's not on like Snapchat, I guess. Maybe I don't know. Is he on Snapchat? Whatever the case is, like Trump, like he's occupied. He's straddling these different modes of media. Which is itself weird, but also, you know, something about the way in which we're given news about Trump is always ready at hand. It's always overwhelming. And in this way that is very much both about Twitter, right? Because I mean, like, hell, I'll wake up. It's been eerie waking up in, like, one of the first things I see in the morning no matter when I do it, is live a Trump tweet, right? Like that moment, like you're emptying your bladder, and then suddenly the president has something to say about like Rosie O'Donnell or some shit, which is a crazy sort of thing. Like, I'm like, you're doing the same thing I am, except you're talking while doing it. But there is like this, like, so there's that, but like, and of course he himself has said too, and this is that other media, the TV media, he's multiple times said that he believes that the collective American memory for any event is about 2 weeks. Right. And he's also said, and that's been paraphrased by multiple sources, so I'm pretty confident that he said it. He's also said that he views every day of his presidency as like an episode of a reality TV show. And as you can hear that, there's constant tells where he's like, well, you'll see what's going to happen. Like, you know, are we going to bomb North Korea? Like, are we going to renege on the Iran deal?
Stay tuned.
We'll find out. Like, stay tuned. Right. But like, all told, it's like, it's this constant dangling and withholding and like cliffhangers and teasing and like all these like Twitter beefs and TV like antagonisms and all these like story arcs and stupid ass characters, right? Like him versus Kaepernick, right? It was, of course, not a stupid character, but like he's producing, it's always entering this weird, highly personalized, like telenovela dialectic that he just sucks everything into.
And the pace of it has this like telescopic, it has this like telescopic quality that ultimately like puts us into this claustrophobic time box of the moment that we can't break out of.
Exactly. It's feverish. It's constantly reactive. It's this cascading series of whiplashes, and you never get out of it. And it's like, oh my God, what's he going to do next, right? Like, who is he going to insult next? Like, is it going to be a war widow? Is it going to be like, he's always topping himself, and we're always sort of like bracing ourselves for some horrible thing to happen next. And I'm not even talking about like the world historical, like thermonuclear war that could claim us all at any moment, but just like some sort of like narrative, like some sort of incredibly cringe-inducing, but like really like queasy, unpleasant, outrageous new development is going to happen, right? I mean, and in some ways, we can like remember when he threatened to send troops to Mexico, like all this, like that's gone down the memory hole because there's been so much of this stupid shit, right? And it was very much tethered to these mediums and to these expectations of these mediums, to Twitter, to TV, and to how those teach us to be like receptive to events.
And what you describe as really a post-circadian temporality or something.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, it's like the news cycle. You have to be. It's like I think that there's. Watch, I'll pop on in a second. But like, there is like a way in which, like, in order to constantly be quote unquote on top of all this, you basically have to be a like constantly tethered to a device, and possibly also a little bit strung out on something. Right? Like, I think there is a way in which, like, Eric Garland is, like, a poor man's Michael Wolff, if you will, right? This moment is producing these very attenuated subject positions of receptivity and commentary on the Trump phenomena, right, which he both produces but also crystallizes.
To follow the president that does not read books requires this engagement, this constant engagement with social media that precludes you reading books either.
That's exactly right. That's exactly right. But then this book comes along, and like, look, the book is not a masterpiece. It's not like a ethical, like it in of itself may well be forgotten within a matter of weeks or days. And it's striking that in some ways it has been almost already. Right. But the simple fact that it's pages that you turn or like Kindle stuff that you flip, the fact that it isn't immediately digestible, and even a lot of it is like, and then Trump tweeted this crazy shit, or then Trump did this thing, and like, sure, it recapitulates that sort of breakneck pace, but it still is a book. It's a legacy media. It's like an artifact from another earlier time. It's like, it's this codex of the present, and in this crazy way, simply slowing down enough to read it as opposed to just immediately react and retweet and be like, oh my God, or turn off the TV or just cringe or whatever, it produces this really on Twitter, everyone is always like, let this sink in, right? As a tag. I'm like, what the fuck does that mean, right? So it's like, well, it's like like meaning is self-present, but like let this sink in, right? When it's a book, it actually does sink in a way that like you don't have to say let this sink in at the end of your tweet. It actually like it just keeps going, and you're like, and so Wolf walks us through 9 months of sheer absurd insanity, and independent of all the questions of how accurate it is, and independent of all these other questions, it both crystallizes this feeling that I think we've all, or that many of us have been having, but also just sort of dilates it, and the effect is horrifying. Frankly, it's a horrifying read in that way. So yeah, it's what we already have always been feeling, but it's been like slowed down and just shoved. Just enough of a remove that it's on the page as opposed to on the phone, and that in and of itself is something singular.
And one thing he does a lot of, according to your review, at least I've not read the book yet, is quoting Trump's speeches at length. And I think that's really interesting way to go about representing Trump, and a good way to go about representing Trump as someone who has had the misfortune of spending many hours listening to Trump speeches, campaign rally speeches in their entirety, because there's this way that even the unflatteringly accurate manner that newspapers quote from Trump's speeches sanitize and make more normal these discourses that are profoundly bizarre. And this book describes all of his aides listening to these utterly bizarre rants full of non sequitur after non sequitur, attempting to divine what his policy position is or what possible policy positions he might be amenable to being convinced that he does hold, even if he didn't previously.
To Wolf's credit, right? I mean, like, if you or I or anyone has ever had the dubious experience of like having their own if you ever read a transcript of what you've said, or if for example someone were to like transcribe out what we're saying now, we would both sound like, you know, like, not that we
which they might, and it'll be, and then that'll be edited.
Great. One of my tunes, though, but like, there is this way in which it's like, you know, like human speech is not written prose, and the way in which we talk with all sorts of vocal fry and pauses and non-coordinated pronouns, etc., like, we can all sound a little disjointed and a little bit like loose. To his credit, Wolf is not like giving us all the ums and the ahs and the weird like verbal gestures that Trump does. Like, these are just like, you know, he cleans it up and he just gives us this full block of what Trump says without necessarily the stutters or like the applause lines or all this other goofy physical comedy. So it's not like he's abusing the translation between speech to text. You just get this full paragraph of like what he says to the CIA in front of their wall of like the honored dead or whatever they call it. And even then, it's still batshit. Like, there's no, like, the topicality is completely crazy. He'll veer from talking about, like the sacrifices people make to talking about how he's been so offended by the media. And then he'll be talking about his morning routine. And then he'll be talking about, like, Florida. It's not coherent. It's the type of thing where you're like, how is no one stopping this? And imagining, and of course, like, it's still on the printed page. It's not, like, chiseled into marble. But it something about it being put in that way is terrifying. And then, of course, there's an added thing where it's like, as you point to, where his own staff, and Bannon specifically, try to figure out what the fuck he's saying and what the fuck his intentions are. And it's been pointed out rather astutely by a bunch of folks that this doesn't, like, this non-trivially resembles. So if you've read any, this is, I'm all over the place verbally, and if you were to transcribe this, it would sound terrible. But if you've read any books about like authoritarian leaders, and here specifically I'm thinking Kershaw's book on Hitler, there's this, Kershaw has this idea of working towards the Führer, right? Where it's like, you know, who Hitler would just talk for hours and hours and hours. And Benjamin Kunkel is the first person who pointed this out to me, like would just talk for hours and hours in these meandering ways. And then all his staff would try and figure out, well, what the fuck does this mean? Like, what does he want to do with the Ukraine? Like, and would then go back to him with his own also tweaked out speeches and be like, well, this must be what the case is. And then they'd present his own ideas back to him and he'd co-sign them or not. And
is,
not
Trump,
necessarily,
is Trump
I'm
on meth?
Like, well, that's, that has, looks like there has been the, I mean, no comment on that one, right? There has been a talk about, like, him being on, like, the fentanyl, like, the, oh, my God, whatever, that off-brand paramyth diet pill since the 80s, but I have no idea. Like, again, like, this is all speculation. Who the fuck knows, right? It almost doesn't matter. We just have these blocks of tests that we have to interpret, but, like, this idea that people, he is simply producing verbiage, and then other people have to try and parse it back to him. And, you know, again, like, I'm not doing a crude, like, Trump is the authoritarian personality and the way that Hitler is, like, I'm not saying that. I'm saying that, like, this is what emerges when you have someone who is manifestly unqualified to be in a position of power and whose management style also involves deploying a whole bunch of underlings with unclear authorities who are set to compete against each other, and which is how the Trump operation has worked. And what that basically produces is all these different people struggling to interpret the dear leader best to the dear leader, which is insane. Like it's simply insane.
A lot of people on the left, myself very much included, were pretty critical of the liberal mantra that this is not normal in the early days of the Trump presidency, because so much of what is so awful about Trump is a continuation or intensification or result of the contradictions of horrible American politics at their most banal. But as this book clearly demonstrates, it's also important to emphasize just how much of a bizarre monster this man is. How do you, and then another, you know, tension is he is like profoundly unqualified for the job. How do you, that on the one hand, but on the other hand, not following into the Hillary Clinton-esque way of describing a technocratic justification for rule in a democratic society when the argument being made is that I am the most capable of overseeing this neoliberal order of global empire. Mm-hmm. So how do you square those circles?
This is a question that's been keeping me up at night since before the election. I wish I could say that there were an easy, that I knew of the answer to this, right? And if there's one thing that Wolf's book does do, like it does sensationalize a lot of these things, and there are moments where it's like, oh, this is something new about Trump. For example, and this, I didn't get into this in the review, but Juan Cole has written about this very persuasively and very intelligently. He's brilliant. You know, it's pretty clear that Trump gave the go-ahead to the Mohammed bin Salman coup in Saudi Arabia, right? And there's this open question where it's like, was Salman going to do this anyways, or is this a new twist in American Saudi relations? And then the answer is probably he was going to do this anyways, and Trump just sort of recklessly got Jared Kushner to co-sign it, because actually, and this is a crazy line, Kushner and Salman are like, they bonded and they reminisced about how like they have a friendship that will be like what they would have had in boarding school or some other crazy shit like that. These are networks of patronage. The end of this is a global, like, you know, like this is our ruling class, and in all its zany absurdity and craziness, and they pre-existed the Trump administration in much in the same ways, like the specific arms deals that that have been signed with the Saudis have long pre-existed, you know, our Obama era artifacts as well, right? So it's like, so there is this way in which, like, yes, this is a continuation of how the American enterprise has functioned for quite some time. And, you know, I think that point can't be understated, right? This, I actually, just to give an example of, like, I think, like, there's a weird way in which Eric Garland specifically, and maybe he's too niche to be talking about. I don't really know.
No, keep talking about Eric Garland, please.
Yeah, this was one of the most, like, so the other thing I do besides, like, the Trump Watch is I write a lot about the arms trade, and I write a lot about gun control and gun violence, and one of the more distressing encounters I ever had on Twitter was with Garland and his followers, and it was about how Trump had invited Erdogan to the White House, right, and then another Turkish leader, Recep to have Erdogan to the White House, and Eric Garland's response was explicitly what you just said, like, this is not normal. And a simple Google will show that Obama had Erdogan to the White House multiple times. And they had a Rose Garden speech, and Obama says all these lovely things about what's it like to be raising daughters as the leader of your country, and then he and Erdogan share a laugh, right? So, like, first of all, like, clear, there's nothing new about the fact that Trump has a relationship with a strongman, and I said this on Twitter, and then everyone was like, well, you know, it's changed, everything's so different now, and I'm like, well, you know, it's not like there was the Gezi Square incident, and then there's been a Turkish crackdown. I'm like, well, you know, we didn't really stop selling arms to the Turks after that happened, at which point Garland's people and Garland blocked me immediately, and then other people were like, well, that's fake news. Right, and like at this point, like I'm like posting links to, you know, U.S. State Department releases about sales of missiles to the Turks, to the Turkish government, by the Obama administration, and they're calling this fake news. And I'm like, which goes to what you're indicating, right? Where it's like there, we have this. I think there's a particular liberal mindset that is encountering for the first time these continuities of American empire and militarism, but is simply locating them narrowly in Trump and perceiving that as not normal.
Which requires this like retrospective exculpation of everything that has passed before.
Precisely.
But it must not, but it must not. Like we as smart left-wing analysis analysts must walk and chew gum at the same time and both describe Trump as the sociopathic, utterly strange monster that he is, also fault Obama for deporting a record number of people and deepening and expanding the global war, the permanent global war on terror that now Trump has inherited and the imperial presidency that goes along with it. And while we're walking and chewing gum, also like patting our head and rubbing our tummy or however that works, and not forgetting that George W. Bush is a war criminal who should be in prison. Like we can hold all of these things in our mind at once.
And this gets to this question of like what makes Trump different versus what is sort of a continuity. And in some ways also, like, this is part of what's also horrifying about the Wolf book, right, is that he narrates how all these corporate figures who have previously said, you know, Trump has this like corporate counsel or whatever that a lot of people have since resigned for, but like from like how they, after he wins, even though they didn't think he was going to win and they denounced him, they show up. They start calling and they start making connections. Like, you know, Jared is a smart guy. Like, so clearly there is some profound continuities. And one of the things that is, and again, like, it's hard to maintain this, right? This is sort of dual consciousness, but to be aware that there are these profound continuities which are obscene and must be interrogated and rejected. But also, there is a way in which Trump clearly is erratic, and you know, like it he does quite realistically have the power to just destroy the world, right? Which is a crazy thing to say, and to somehow bear those things in mind simultaneously is really distressing, and a likewise distressing thought is to realize how much of, just like in terms of just the affect, I'm not talking about the fact-based dimension of it, our like collective disgust with Trump mirrors a lot of the collective disgust on the right with Obama. That's a queasy thing to realize, right? Like I can't see Trump show up on a TV screen without part of me bracing for something painful, right? Like the simple sight of him provokes anxiety and disgust in me. Now, I know I talked to a lot of people through my other work who felt that exact same way about Obama. Now, my hatred of Trump may be, you know, as the old Cockburn line goes, my hatred of Trump, our hatred of Trump may be pure, right? And they may well have hated that they did hate Obama just because he was black. But it is kind of terrifying to consider that the way
and the Muslim board in Kenya. I mean, to be fair,
exactly. It's not fact based. Pure, like, but it is kind of terrifying to think that maybe this is actually how the American project is proceeding, right? We have these 4 or 8 year long, like, quote unquote, derangement syndromes, to borrow a phrase from Charles fucking Krauthammer, where we just like hate the president and think everything about him is evil. And then it switches over and suddenly America's great and good again. And meanwhile, the process of our being the world's largest arms exporter and our being at war, you know, our having troops in 170, 180 countries proceeds. And so the idea that, and in some ways, like, that's almost like what's almost so scary about the Trump administration is how much the same apparatus of state, and has proceeded. I'm not gainsaying the horrors that are happening environmentally and that long-term ticking time bomb. I'm not gainsaying the immediate harms that are being visited through deportations and ICE, all that. But it is a terrifying thing to think about that whether the person sitting in the Oval Office is a hyper-competent technocrat or a monstrous, mentally unfit bigot, certain aspects of the state and the American empire just keep going. And that's talk about like vertiginous, that's a frightening thing to think about, but it's something I think we need to keep thinking about and develop some sort of mobilize in some way. I don't know how.
And to resist this roller coaster of an interpretation that Americans, both Republicans and Democrats, are increasingly on, which is this process of a feeling of falling and America being lost and then redeemed again when our side wins. It obscures these deeper, disturbing truths. Some of the points in your review, I think, were amplified by a Facebook post. I'm not sure if you saw it, made by Jeff Charlotte.
Oh yeah.
Who, for listeners, is a really talented writer and journalist. He wrote, "I hear wonks, activists, and theorists ever dismissive of quote gossip, as they are so often of stories, whining that Wolf's book is distracting us from the real issues or the real fight. I believe that the real fight involves cracking the spine of the Trumpist movement. Does Wolf's book do that? Of course not. But by decisively creating rifts between Trump and one of his most potent media allies, Steve Bannon, and between Bannon and the billionaire Mercers, Wolf's book has hit Trumpism harder than everything in or on The Nation, The New Republic, the liberal talk shows, et cetera, combined. This is not even to speak of the many other smaller dents it has put in Trumpism, the lower echelon figures whose betrayals may not make cable news, but will surely be tallied and avenged by Trump and his trolls, leading to more Trumpist coalition crackup." My question for you is what role should we as outside analysts and agitators assign to gossip and palace intrigue? How do we incorporate it into a broader critical analysis, an analysis that aims to play a role of some sort in destroying the Trump administration and, referring back to what we were just discussing prior to this, replacing it with something much better?
Jeff is a friend, and I think Jeff is quite right in that. And that is like the value of the book. And I think you can't underscore how much I think he's quite right too, in the way in which like a lot of the establishment media, so to speak, like disgust with Wolf's project. And I'm not saying Wolf isn't a sleazy like person. He totally is. Like the opening scene of the book is a dinner he has in his house, which he doesn't really disclose, because you know it's that like Mark Halperin game change horse race, like people or great figures doing great things thing, where he's like, you know, there's a dinner and Steve Bannon is there and Roger Ailes is there, and it's like, where is this dinner? It turns out it's at Michael fucking Wolff's house, right? But like, but there is a way in which like a lot of how much contemporary establishment media, and I'm thinking people at the Times, I'm thinking people, you know, people who are on the Trump beat are angry at Wolf, and even Masha Gessen, but like God love her, like are so upset at Wolf's methods. The implicit counterpoint seems to be, well, it should be a better type of journalism that is non-gossipy, that is rigorous, etc. And the implicit counterpoint, the implicit example, I think, there is the work of Bob Woodward with the Bush administration, right? Those two or three books about
Bush at War. These hagiographic portraits of our commander-in-chief in the global war on terror, utterly nauseating.
Exactly. And it's like, and like there is, and like, you know, those are books like, again, I suffered through all of them, and it's like there is stuff in there that like, oh yeah, Bush is an incompetent piece of shit and Dick Cheney is a monster and these people are compromised and corrupt and they're indifferent to the deaths of hundreds of thousands of people. Totally. It's totally scandalous in that way, right? But it's not like Bob Woodward's book got anyone in the upper level echelon of the administration fired, right? So there's a way in which like I think there's a lot of the media response, a lot of the establishment media response to Wolf is what I guess like Freud would call the narcissism of small differences, right? Like the fact that Wolf is burning bridges with all these assholes who may be his bedfellows and who he deserves and who deserve him is so taboo precisely because a lot of quote-unquote establishment work involves making pacts with these people precisely on the condition that it not actually produce any political consequences, right? And, like, I'm not sure, I don't know if Trumpism is a definite quantity, right? This is a major question in Wolf's book, and his conclusion basically is the reason Bannon is so central to the Trump enterprise is because, and look, I've entertained discussions of Trumpism myself. I think Trumpism might be certain things vis-a-vis nationalism, white supremacy, et cetera, and like all this eternal chauvinism, whatever. But like, there's a way in which one of Wolf's major points is that the reason Bannon is so central to the Trump and was so central to the Trump administration was not just because he was available and Trump was, you know, scraping the bottom of the barrel, but also because he had the pretense of a semi-coherent or what passed for a semi-coherent, but it was actually an incoherent ideology, which was Trumpism, right? So Trump and the people around him are actually constantly in search of something called Trumpism, which doesn't really exist. And that, so to get your specific question, though, which is like, what the fuck do we do to that? Part of me feels like the answer has to be stop caring about the presidency. Like, the fact that we could have either a hyper-competent technocrat or a blatantly incompetent asshole in the White House and the state enterprise still continues should point to the fact that maybe the point of leverage and the point of real attention and the point of like coalition building and power should be happening on a much more grassroots level and should be happening at least within the confines of the American like political enterprise in terms of congresspeople, in terms of senators, in terms of mayors, in terms of governors, in terms of local representatives. So like that's where the actual force has to happen, right? And in some way, that's also like there's a way in which like the Trumpist project, again, like whatever Trumpism is all about fetishizing this imaginary grassroots, right? And I think there's part of the reason that liberals are so infatuated with the idea of like, you know, like this mythic white working class that's all turned out for Trump, right? And whatever that may mean, is again that they love the idea of an organic grassroots, but they want to have their cake and eat it too and just focus on the horse race stuff. I think the answer is probably to reject the horse race drama gossip shit entirely, or at least view it for what it is and focus on the local, the proximate, and like the multiplier effect of grassroots work, because that's what can actually, I think, really change this. And that's why the stuff in the election of Virginia has been so heartening. That's why I hope what happens in 2018 will prove heartening. But the idea is that the question isn't who are the clowns in the car, right? It's having a different vehicle entirely. And, you know, like short of like a dictatorship of the proletariat, like there has to be some sort of focus on who is being hurt by these policies? What is being damaged in our country by these policies? How is the environment being affected by these policies? Like, where is the harm happening to actual, real people? Not to talk about, like, the fantasy grievance politics of, you know, Steve fucking Bannon, white working class whisperer, but actually, like, let's focus on people actually suffering and mobilizing them. Not focus again on obviously like, there is this way too in which like that stark binary split between people who hate Trump, people who love him, like that's just going to be reconfirmed and is also reconfirmed. That's not going to change and is also reconfirmed by the media's single-minded fixation on, you know, what do Trump voters think now?
Trump voter, newsflash, Trump voters still support Trump.
Exactly. And so I'm like, who gives a fuck about what the Trump voters think at this point? Let's think about the people who didn't vote at all. Right? Like there's a majority of this country that is not, that is disengaged from the political process. What's their position? How can we politically activate them? And in some ways, like that's not what Michael Wolff cares about, right? Michael Wolff cares about money and people who have sexy positions and crazy lives, right? And that's not what the New York Times for the most part is going to care about for reasons that are both structural and political, for reasons that are like explicitly ideological and that are implicitly ideological. But I do think the question has to be like, what about the non-voter? like just bracket the binary, bipolar, voting cycle stuff, bracket the fixation on the, and I'm not saying you can't enjoy the Wolf book, like it maybe like it can be an experience of like eating all your Halloween candy one night and being like, okay, I don't ever want to eat candy again, at least not doing it for a while, right? Like there are pleasures and value in this type of stuff, like whatever it may be, even if the calories are empty. But there has to be some other type of like slow food, right? Something more nutritious that actually produces a healthier body politic if we want to pursue that metaphor further. And that's where the future, that's where I think there's hope for a future, is focusing on that. So, you know, enjoy the Mike Wolff book. Like, it's fun, like, it's horrifying, whatever. But then after that, like, just, you know, get involved in a fucking union or something. Like, you know, like.
After that, get an N+1 subscription, listen to this podcast, and organize for socialism and power in the workplace. And I think we're good.
You know what? Fucking A. I'm all for that. Just, please, I'll co-sign that. Like, absolutely.
Well, Patrick Blanchfield, thank you very much.
Thank you. It was an earnest pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Patrick Blanchfield is a freelance writer and associate faculty member at the Brooklyn Institute for Social Research, recently published in N+1. Thank you for listening to The Dig from Jacobin Magazine. As Marx once said after suggesting that all Trump haters read The 18th Brumaire to truly understand what's going on, while other podcasts have only interpreted the world in various ways, our point is to change it. We are posting new episodes every week. The Dig was produced by Alex Lewis, music by Jeffrey Brodsky. Follow us on Twitter at The Dig Radio, and please find us wherever you get podcasts and subscribe. If you listen to us on iTunes, please log in and give us a review. Not only does that feed the iTunes corporate Borg, it helps introduce the show to new listeners, which is a good thing. Another thing that helps introduce us to new listeners is you telling your friends about the show. Please do so. All propaganda on our behalf is greatly appreciated. And lastly, please find us on patreon.com/thedig and make a contribution. Even a few bucks a month is a big help.